Case number 24-5089, In Re Sealed Case. Mr. Holzblatt for the appellant, Mr. Lenners for the appellee.
May it please the court, Ari Holzblatt for X. The district court committed two errors. Its omnibus non-disclosure order defies 18 USC 2705B and the First Amendment, and the court violated due process by adjudicating X's challenge to the order based on ex parte materials. The government's 11th hour disclosure of the delegating order underscores both errors. The order was withheld even though it contains nothing requiring secrecy. And now that we have it, we've learned that it applies to any subpoena issued for the account of any user on any platform in this entire investigation for an entire year, and that it empowers the government, not the court, to determine whether disclosing a specific subpoena will result in a statutory harm. That's unlawful. Section 2705B requires the court to make that assessment, not the government. And it requires the court to assess non-disclosure for specific subpoenas, not hypothetical ones. Now that's clear first from the text of the statute, which says the court orders non-disclosure if, quote, it, meaning the court, determines that statutory harms will result from disclosing, quote, the subpoena. The language tells us who needs to make the assessment, the court, not the government, and what needs to be assessed, the subpoena, which means a document that is particular, in existence, not hypothetical. Now, there are other cues from the statutory scheme. If we compare this to other statutory schemes, 2705A and 2709, for example, allow the government alone to demand non-disclosure. The Wiretap Act bars disclosure for all wiretaps out of recognition that informing the target of a wiretap will always impede its effectiveness.
Do those other statutes violate the First Amendment?
They do not, Your Honor, or I don't know that they do, because, and I think the Wiretap Act is a good example.
Your First Amendment argument here, treat them as prior restraints? You made a First Amendment argument here separate from your statutory argument.
Yes, I think for example, the Wiretap Act would be a prior restraint. It would have to satisfy strict scrutiny. I think it could. And the reason is because the informing the target of a wiretap is always going to impede its effectiveness. If someone knows their phone is tapped, then they're going to change the way they speak on the phone. And so a categorical judgment serves the compelling interest that the government has. That's not the case. In fact, Congress made that judgment. That's not the case in Rule 6, where witnesses generally are permitted to speak about the fact that they've received process. And it's not true in 2705, which serves a very important, 2705B is serving very important purposes, which is balancing the intrusion on the rights, both of the provider and of the users, against the government's, what may be the government's compelling need in particular circumstances. And so I think where the statutory scheme is serving a different purpose, it's going to operate in a different way, and the First Amendment interest will play out differently.
On the statutory question,
yes.
I just want to understand, there's several factors I think you listed that in your view make this NDO improper. And one of them is just that there's no specific subpoena in hand. So just to understand the contours of that, imagine if the government came forward to the judge and said, in about a month, we're going to get one specific subpoena getting, but it's a very specific, they can describe it at the time. Can't a judge in that situation make the determination the statute requires there's reason to believe disclosing that subpoena will cause a listed harm? Or I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, no, I understand. I understand.
Is it ex ante enough, or is it something else about this case?
There's two points I'd like to make about that, Your Honor. So the first is that even if, and I'll address Your Honor's hypothetical, but even if that were the case, it would not justify the delegating order in this case because it's far broader. Okay, so but with respect to Your Honor's hypothetical, I still think it wouldn't be, we don't think that's the best reading of the statute, and I want to explain why, which is that facts change, circumstances change. A concern that a target may destroy evidence or intimidate a witness or flee might be true if the target is on the loose, and if they've been arrested, it would no longer be true. It may be true if the investigation is covert. It may no longer be true if the target has been indicted.
So what's different on that in that respect from any NDO? Because the court is always making a judgment that not only it might be next week before they serve the subpoena, but they're also deciding an amount of time for which the subpoena can't be disclosed. And at least in some respect, there's always something forward-looking and predictive about what the court is doing, isn't there?
I think that's true, Your Honor, but I do think the statute, I think this text of the statute strikes the balance as to the way this is supposed to work. So I suppose the scheme could say the government can come in and say, we want a general non-disclosure regime for this investigation. I think that's basically what the not delegating order did here. And then we're going to leave it to the court, to the government, to make assessments on a subpoena by subpoena basis. That's not, I think, the answer the statute provides. The answer the statute provides is it says ex ante, you have to come in with particular, the subpoena with particular legal process and make that assessment in advance. And it's true that there will be contexts where there's some future-oriented look. And in fact, I think generally that's why now NDOs have to be time limited. But I think the more we particularize it, the more we make it in advance, the more it makes sense. And I think the statutory context reinforces this. So 2705B applies not just to subpoenas, but it also applies to warrants and to D orders. With respect to warrants and D orders, the government...
A D order?
It's an order that's authorized under 2703D of the statute. So, I'm sorry, I should not have used the language. So there are three types of legal process that are available under the Stored Communications Act. A subpoena, the government can issue by itself, but the 2703D order and a warrant, the government has to come to the court to seek authorization. And so naturally, the government seeks non-disclosure with respect to a particular instrument at the same time. And I think it's natural to read 2705B as working the same way for all three types of legal process that are covered by the statute. Now, and there's good reason for this. The purposes that are being served by the statute is to permit non-disclosure, yes, in a narrow set of circumstances, but Congress is recognizing that this is impacting the rights of providers and users. Again, a non-disclosure order is a prior restraint. It impedes the rights of the provider, but it also impacts the rights of the user, because if they don't know about the subpoena, they're unable to protect.
I'm not sure you're in the shoes to speak for them.
Well,
or any injury to them.
I think it matters for how we construe the statutory scheme. So we cited the House report on 2705B, specifically speaking about 2705, and it says one of the purposes of Section 2705 is to provide users confidence that they would have an opportunity to protect their own rights. They lose that opportunity to protect their own rights if the provider is not permitted to disclose that they've received that subpoena. And so I think it's important that when we construe the statutory text, we're not suggesting that we have standing to assert the rights of the users, but in construing the statutory text, I think it matters what Congress's purposes were with the statute.
So, building on Judge Garcia's question, the government went to court and said, we've got a grand jury engaged in a very, very confidential, but very intense investigation. And we are going to have to issue 20 subpoenas. And we're going to do it in the next 2 weeks. And then gives a general description, obviously, to support what those subpoenas are. And they cannot be disclosed. This is a grand jury. Disclosure will reveal the existence of a grand jury and the direction of a grand jury and witnesses and or targets. You're one or the other. You're getting one of these of the grand jury. So uniformly across the board, that's going to happen in these cases. And we've got this list of subpoenas we're going to have to issue. Would that be permissible under the statute? And if not, what in the text forecloses that?
So I think, again, that's not what the delegating order does here. I think if the government has this 20 subpoenas and it knows which providers and for which accounts and for which users, then it can attach those subpoenas to the non-disclosure order application. And I think that would be fine. And I the court may disagree. The court may the court may disagree that, you know, it's sufficient if you just provide a description of every meet and bound of the subpoena without actually stapling the subpoena to the application. That's not my read of the statute. But the court may well disagree with my read of the statute. I do think you have to have described who the account is, who the user is, who the platform is, when it's being served, and why the statutory factors are satisfied with respect to that.
You have to show when it's being served? Is that in the statute?
Well, the statute requires that the subpoena, that disclosure of the subpoena will result in the statutory harms. I think that if the subpoena is being served 364 days from now, I think that predictive judgment is challenging.
I think that's probably a bit fanciful.
Well, let me ask you, counsel, then, following up on your response to Judge Millett's question, what is your criticism then of the district court's analysis here, saying that taking the order that is now moot by characterizing what information was provided to the magistrate judge, it could have been done in a way that didn't disclose the type of detail that you are suggesting is desirable, but it was sufficient to meet the statutory requirement. And the district court went through that sort of step by step. He dismissed your, you know, article argument and focused on one of the points here about who decides. But I need to understand exactly what your criticism, legal criticism, is of that approach to an omnibus order.
Your Honor, I think what matters is the breadth of the order. This particular order applies to any subpoena issued for the account
I'm with Judge Millett. All right, she's narrowed it down to 20. All right, the district court was talking about two. So I'm just trying to understand. The district court took the position it didn't adopt the interpretation of the statute you were reading, that anything with less particularity would fail either as a matter of statute or constitutional law.
I understood that the district court to have said that the order, that the omnibus order that is reflected at Supplemental Appendix 1 to 2, is consistent with the statute and the First Amendment. The omnibus order that is found in Supplemental Appendix 1 to 2, and we didn't argue this to the district court because this order was not disclosed to us until the red brief on appeal, that order is not limited to a subpoena that was issued to X for the particular accounts in this case. That order lasts for an entire year. It covers the entire investigation. It covers any account on any platform.
As that's why I'm asking you to give us your argument now that you've seen this order. You know, the district court says these things are being issued all over the country. And I understand maybe not so far approved other than maybe in one of our earlier cases, but he talks about you have a situation that identifies the specific category of providers. You recall that, correct? The specific category of subpoenas, describing the particular legal process, and with to be used only with the same set of facts. I'm just trying to understand how far your argument goes.
Well, yes, Your Honor. I think what we're looking at is on Supplemental Appendix page 2. These are the facts that are listed, the supposed limits. This is in paragraph 5.
Yes.
The only specific facts that are identified is that the subpoena is part of the government's investigation, that's the entire investigation, that the account is covered by the Stored Communications Act, so that's the entire statute, that the account is relevant the investigation. Again, that's the entire investigation. That it's a subpoena. That's any type of subpoena. And, quote, the disclosure of the existence of the subpoena would result in potential targets attempting to evade apprehension or destroy or encrypt evidence or otherwise seriously jeopardizing the investigation. So to the extent
I understand that, counsel, but help me here, and maybe you just don't want to answer this question. When the district court looked at this, he said, you know, he wasn't going to deal with hypothetical facts, hypothetical subpoenas, but take as a template the order that was issued in this case. He at least suggested not that the one that you're looking at now and that we're looking at now, but this is not a categorical decision, that there could be an omnibus order that would meet the statutory requirements as set forth by Congress.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I'm sorry if I'm not answering the question, but what I understood the district court to have said is that this order, which I just quoted, complies with the statute in the First Amendment, and I think there are two problems with that. The first is that the last language I read, those are the 2705B statutory factors. So the way that this order is working, it is saying not that the court is assessing those factors, it's saying the government is going to assess those factors. The text of the statute says it, the court, has to determine that those factors are satisfied. So I think that's—
But I thought Judge Millett's question was trying to get you to respond to the notion that the government files a request that lists 20 targets, that lists 20 parties like your client, and it is a year, but it's very clear what the government is focusing on.
So, Your Honor, I think that would not be this order or this case, and I think we would disagree that that would be authorized under the statute because we think the statute requires that the subpoenas be in existence at the time that the assessment is made. But even if the court disagrees with me about that, I think we would still need to reverse here because of the language that I just read, which actually assigned the task of evaluating the factors not to the court, but to the—
Yes,
but
no, I understand that argument, yes.
So just I just wanted to clarify one thing. It seemed, I think this is right, but your position doesn't really have anything to do with it being multiple subpoenas. If there were 50 subpoenas in hand, they could come and get a single order, at least on your reading of the statute that you're passing in this case.
Yeah, I agree, Your Honor. The two restrictions that I'm identifying are the court, not the government, needs to make the assessment. The subpoenas need to be particular and exist. If you can do that with more than one subpoena.
Can I ask about another
issue? Just to follow up on Judge Rogers, super quick. So is your position now an as-applied challenge only? For obvious reasons, it was facial in district court.
I guess I'm not sure that our challenge has ever been anything other than as-applied, but I agree that our challenge is about the omnibus order, which authorized the NDO that was issued in this case.
I'm sorry, just clear.
No. So if we agreed with you that this order is not authorized under the statute, would there be any reason to address any other issue in the case, including this ex parte issue?
Thank you. And I realize I'm over time, so I apologize for that, but I'll obviously answer your question. I suppose there wouldn't if the government, in answer to your question, says, if we lose, we will not seek rehearing and we will not petition for certiorari. I'd be surprised if my friend is able to make that representation, but I think the litigation is ongoing. And as we've already learned from the presentation in the briefing in this case, some of what has been held ex parte bears on the statutory questions that we've been debating. It's actually why we have a pending, I think it was referred to the panel, there's a pending motion regarding the ex parte materials, where I think our position is even stronger now that facts have changed in the case than it was even in the district court.
I guess my question is, because your access to the ex parte evidence is not, you know, it's not a FOIA case. It's not disclosure for disclosure's sake. You want, and you moved for access to that evidence so you could challenge the order. And so it strikes me that, you know, if our judgment said, this gets a little bit weird because the case is moot, but, you know, reversed, you win. I don't think a court would ever issue a judgment that also says, and even if not, we would remand for consideration of the ex parte evidence.
So I don't want to, I would love to win on our first issue. I agree. I do think there's two reasons, and I'll, and if that's the judgment of the court, I understand, but
improper right to give dicta about something that's not an alternative holding.
Well, so I
a sort of a lesser fallback argument.
So I guess I agree. I can see where the court's coming from. I'll tell you two reasons why for counter consideration. So number one, it appears to me, I can't fully answer this question, but it does appear to me that there are materials within the ex parte materials that may bear on the statutory question. And if the litigation were to continue at en banc or certiorari, I would not want to be disabled from addressing those arguments by having access to those materials. The second is, as Your Honor noted, both, you know, we are in capable of repetition, yet evading review land already. And so I don't think we would be exactly an advisory opinion. I think the mootness issue is the mootness issue. But I understand the court's perspective. Would the court like me to address the ex parte issue as well? I know I'm well over my time.
No, so
I don't
want
to do that.
It's fine. I still had some more questions about the statutory argument. And that is, if the government were to come in, just there's hypotheticals, you don't have to, you can decide, they can
tell
if I think this is this one or not, but were to come in and say, grand jury, impressive time, very urgent here. And we are going to be issuing dozens of subpoenas every week. And they will go to one of the statutory providers here, but we still haven't figured out exactly which ones, but it will be, and you can issue you can limit the order to those that are statutory qualifying providers. We will agree to the time limit. But Your Honor, for efficiency reasons, here's our argument as to why a non-disclosure order will be required in every one of those cases, because this is a grand jury. And disclosure of a grand jury, the fact of a subpoena issuing will, in all of those cases, reveal the existence of the grand jury and will reveal target and or witness for the grand jury and direction of the grand jury's investigation. Obviously, if for some reason the grand jury stops working, we, of course, will not come back with any more subpoenas, so it will be a non-issue. But the order is going to look exactly the same as the non-disclosure order. It'll be a common one that you'll issue in every case. The findings will be the same because that is the nature of grand jury operations, or this grand jury's operations. Just say this grand jury's operations. That is the nature of them. You just can't be revealing this stuff while they're underway. I don't care if a witness says something later. There will be no official governmental recognition of the existence of this grand jury, its operations, its targets, its witnesses, and the course of its investigation. Why can't a court, as long as a court makes a judgment up front that any subpoenas issued in the next year, I don't know, are they going to want to issue it on day 364 since it'll be disclosed on day 365 or 366, but any subpoena issued as part of this grand jury number doing the grand jury investigation against statutorily authorized providers is going to present the exact same harm each and every time. So it's not transferring the decision to them. The judge has made the harm finding. The judge has said only statutorily authorized providers. And the judge has said what the time limit is. I don't see anything in the statutory text that forecloses that. And what is wrong with that?
So, Your Honor, efficiency is not one of the five statutory factors under 2705B.
No, I'm told you they've made the qualifying statutory findings about it's going to imperil a grand jury investigation. That's what I meant by exposing the existence of it, the direction, the targets, the witnesses.
Your Honor, I think it's so. I don't think that's what the I don't think that's the statutory scheme. The statutory scheme says the court needs to assess the particular subpoena, and that requires
the argument.
Well, even if the court doesn't buy the argument, it does require that the court itself be the one that make the assessment. And I think the fact,
and I'm telling you, the court has made the assessment. It's just made it in advance because nothing is going to change. It is a common, I take this to be sort of the district court's rationale. It's going to be the same harm will exist in every one of these as long as it's this grand jury with this investigation. But I'm going to give you a time limit.
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to make two observations about that. The first is that that's actually not even how Rule 6 works. So Rule 6, with respect to...
That's not how Rule 6 works.
So I think that the notion that a witness discovering that there's a grand jury somehow automatically impedes the investigation is actually inconsistent with how Rule 6 works. And so I think it's problematic in that regard. And the second point I'd like to make, Your Honor, is that I think, and
because
this is
a witness can come out and say, I got something, at which point you have no value in telling them anything, right? There's no reason for you to be telling them. They're going to find out that they've been the target of this. And all they have revealed to the public is that. And they may be true, they may be lying, but we, you know, witnesses say things all the time, and we don't just draw back the curtain on the grand jury or its direction or its investigation or who else is getting targeted. That doesn't open the door to this information.
That's
post hoc witnesses, and this is all going to be pre witnesses receiving anything.
That's right, Your Honor. But X is a grand jury witness in this context, and so what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the mere fact that people learn of the grand jury investigation is not automatically statutory factors under 2705B, and I think an example would help.
They learn that someone has said, some private person has said, there's a grand jury, and they asked me for something. That's all they learn. You want to go talk to the witnesses themselves, to the targets of the subpoenas themselves.
Well, Your Honor, and I think that's
before they know anything.
Well, Your Honor, an example I think would help illustrate this, which is the breadth of the delegating order in this case is not limited to accounts of targets. It's for any account. So let me give Your Honor an example.
Yes, for any targets or witnesses.
Or anyone. So, Your Honor, anyone's account. So
the plausible, whatever the standard is for grand jury, is going to have sort of the plausible relationship to whatever their investigation is.
That's right. It has to be relevant to the investigation, but that's hardly a limit. Your Honor, an example I think would help illustrate this. Imagine that the government comes to the court and says, if the target of the investigation learns of this investigation, then they will destroy evidence that they may flee. And so if that might justify a non-disclosure order for the account of the target. Now let's imagine, Your Honor, that the government is seeking account information about your account, and you're not the target of the investigation. If you were informed by X that a subpoena had been issued for you for information about your account, it would not automatically tell you. There's nothing on the cover of the subpoena that tells you it's an investigation into me. And there's nothing about that automatically says that you will tell me. And so the rationale for having non-disclosure for a subpoena into my account, the target, is necessarily different than the rationale for non-disclosure as to you.
But it's the one that's constant across these, and that is seriously impede the investigation. I forget the exact statutory phrase, but seriously interfere with the investigation.
But more facts.
It will, by revealing to me that I've received this, that my account received the subpoena, that there is some grand jury that's somehow interested in me.
And
there's some direction. And if you reveal that one, and 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 you reveal that one, you say you get, what, hundreds of these a week or a month?
That's right.
And I'm going to reveal all of these and say, you know, I got these under this grand jury. You're going to reveal the exact mosaic of the investigation.
Well, Your Honor, there's
the notion that the recipient can be trusted to discern when it's safe to release one or the other. I think it's fair for a judge up front to say we just aren't going to have that happen.
Well, it's not the recipient shouldn't be making that judgment, and the government shouldn't be making that judgment.
Why can't do it up front and say it's the nature of this grand jury's proceeding?
Because
it's not enough of an answer.
Well, it can't, because otherwise that would prove far too much. The statute is supposed to be the same House report that I pointed Your Honor to says that the non-disclosure orders are supposed to be provided in, quote, a narrow set of circumstances. Mm-hmm. If just revealing the fact of a grand jury without knowing, if you're told that there was a subpoena for your account, you have no idea necessarily, you might, but you have no idea that it's an investigation into me. And so the government to justify non-disclosure for the second subpoena.
I know it's an investigation that I'm somehow now related to.
That's not enough, Your Honor. The statute requires more than that. If the statute was satisfied simply by learning that there was a grand jury investigation, then it would radically
transform someone that it's interested in, either as a witness or a target.
That would radically transform the statute. The statute is supposed to be limited to circumstances where there is a reason to believe that the person who will learn of the subpoena will impede the investigation. You're going to need specific facts.
If you start telling everybody, it's a lot more information that's leaked out there. It's not as though you're just going to come tell me. You're going to tell every single person. That's your First Amendment claim, to tell it to everybody. And that you're saying the statute allows you to tell it to every single person when you get hundreds of these.
The government needs to actually show that with evidence that that problem would exist. Now, there may be circumstances where that's true, and there's others where it's not. And all that my proposition, which is the premise of the statutory scheme, is that this is a serious intrusion on both the rights of providers and on the rights of users. The purpose of this statute was to ensure that the government could obtain non-disclosure when it was truly necessary under the limited statutory factors that are listed, but also to balance that against the intrusion that it's placing on providers who are facing a prior restraint and on users who are losing their opportunity to protect their own rights. And the reason that I'm trying to explain that the circumstances may differ when, depending on whose account is at issue, depending on the factual circumstances, when the disclosure occurs, whether someone has been arrested by that point, or there has been a publicity around the investigation, is because the facts that are particular to the subpoena matter to the assessment the court needs to make that the statute requires.
And I assume these non-disclosure orders can go be attached, assuming the appropriate statutory showing is made. The subpoena is coming from any corner of the government, right?
The non-disclosure order needs to be issued by the court on application by the government.
No, I understand, but like the subpoenas to which they could attach could come from all manner of investigatory, civil or criminal investigatory.
I believe that's correct, Your
Honor. Right, and so my question is focused very narrowly, as the district court did here, on the subset. And so it's not empty in the statute to say that there are particular categories of investigative activity in which uniformly the harms will be implicated. And if, and I understand you're saying you don't think that's accurate, but if it were accurate that uniformly the disclosure of grand jury subpoenas would impair, I've heard your arguments as to why it might not, but if we get past that and say, if we were to conclude that uniformly disclosure of grand jury subpoenas would seriously interfere with the grand jury investigation, if we found that, then would there still be a statutory problem with as long as the district court makes the right find? And I understand your arguments. Yeah. This is hypothetical, to be clear.
No, I don't think that would justify the non-disclosure order in this case. I'm not actually certain, and I want to withdraw my prior statement. I actually need to confirm the question of whether the subpoenas could be beyond use in a criminal prosecution. But I do think that this would.
And then it would all have to be grand juries.
The paradigmatic use of 2703 is in service of a grand jury investigation. And I think it would be at odds with the statutory language, which speaks of endangering the life or physical safety of an individual, flight from prosecution, destruction or tampering with evidence, intimidation of potential witnesses. Those are the catch-all about seriously jeopardizing an investigation or unduly delaying a trial. All of these are about criminal investigation. And the first four in the list are about very serious intrusions.
The destruction of evidence can also happen with civil enforcement cases.
Your Honor, this statute is intended to deal with criminal investigations, and the first four items in the list, I think, dictate the degree of seriousness of intrusion on the investigation. I mean, we're talking about endangering the life or physical safety, flight from prosecution, destruction or tampering with evidence, intimidation of a potential witness, and then seriously jeopardizing. So the fact that there may be some, yeah, I understand that it is inconvenient, just as with any witness to a grand jury, that there is some information that may be disclosed, but that is not consistent with Congress's judgment that this should be available only in a, quote, narrow set of circumstances.
I understand, then you're, and I may just be wrong, I'm really asking the question about how broadly this thing applies, so maybe it's just criminal matters. And if it's, if the legislative history show that it's really only about grand juries?
So I don't have an answer to your Honor's question, but what I can say is that even, I think the kind of categorical judgment that your Honor is describing is not consistent with the statutory text or context, which speaks about the court making an assessment with respect to a particular subpoena. And I don't think that the ability to make categorical judgments, as your Honor is describing, would be consistent with the concerns that Congress had that, to protect the rights of providers and users. But I also certainly don't think it would justify the non-disclosure order, the delegating order, in this particular context. But Your Honor, even setting that all aside, even in the context of a grand jury investigation, there are significant circumstances that can change. The target of the investigation can be indicted, the target can die, the target may be arrested, and so they are no longer at risk of intimidating witnesses or at flight. And so even setting aside, even if the court believes that every grand jury investigation, revealing any grand jury investigation.
What does that mean? So if the person's indicted, the grand jury is not going to issue any more subpoenas with non-disclosures orders, with an omnibus non-disclosure order attached to them after that moment in time.
I wish that were so, Your Honor. That is not the case. It has been our experience.
So you're saying one person might be indicted, but maybe others that are still being investigated.
No, even after a particular individual has been indicted, the government may continue to investigate
but
them.
But the grand jury continue?
The grand jury may continue. A different grand jury may continue into the same individual. The into the same course.
They were arrested?
It may be the same course of conduct. It may be
this really is just my ignorance. I would have thought once the grand jury indicted a person for a particular crime, the grand jury would no longer investigate that person for that particular crime.
The work of any grand jury may continue into the same course of conduct with respect to the same target. And this is not hypothetical. We have lots of experience with.
Presumably because there's other people they're interested in or other crimes that that person may have committed, but as to that crime.
That's right. But once that individual has, if it is a crime as a part of a general course of conduct, once that individual has been indicted, they know that they are now the subject of governmental investigation. And even if the government could still at that point justify a non-disclosure order, the analysis is different. The assessment is different because now the court needs to assess the factual circumstance in light of the fact that.
Why it's different? Aren't they going to come back and make the same showing? They're going to say, look, this grand jury is not done.
But
we are still looking for compatriots, for co-defendants, for co-conspirators. We are still looking for aiders and abettors. We don't think this may be all the crimes this person did. And so the last person we want to know is that the people that we are still probing, to let them know that we're still working. I think it's going to be the same thing, that it's going to seriously interfere with the ongoing law enforcement grand jury part of the investigation.
So Your Honor, I think even then the assessment would be different, but even the Justice Manual, that's not what the Justice Manual says, Your Honor. I mean, even the Justice Manual,
well,
the Department of Justice.
Paying attention to that, so.
Well, I think it bears on the plausibility of whether or not the 2705B assessment changes depending on the factual context. And so the Department of Justice itself says that as an investigation becomes more public, the justification for a non-disclosure order diminishes. Okay, so that's exactly the example I'm providing, Your Honor. As an investigation.
What we're trying to explore is why you think the statute is inconsistent with what I'm going to call a very particularized order that's anonymous. So the subpoena doesn't name the person, but the government is doing this massive investigation, and you probably know much better than I. I mean, the government's always doing massive investigations, and we rarely hear about them, and they rarely become public because a lot of them don't result in any indictment or legal process that becomes public. I mean, that's the very nature of the grand jury. So I don't know how we can view Congress have sort of written a statute saying we're changing the nature of the government's ability to investigate through the grand jury, subject to certain limitations. But I hear you basically making an argument that I really don't see in the legislative history you've cited us to, even if there's a stray comment here or there. And now you're asking us to, in this case that troubles me about this capable of repetition yet evading review. I mean, one of the concerns I had in the beginning is, how are we supposed to make some judgments about things we don't know? And yet this statute is written with the protection you emphasize that a judicial officer, a judge, has to approve this omnibus order. And I think what Judge Millett is doing so much better than I is trying to explore with you just how far you're going to take this. Because what I hear you saying is, you know, unless you, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but unless you and your clients are informed, nothing can happen in the way of criminal investigations.
Well, Your Honor, I think we have a separate argument about our access to the ex parte materials, which I think.
Right, I understand that.
And I'm happy to address that if that's Your Honor's question. But with respect to the statute itself, I think the question before the court is actually limited to what appears on supplemental appendix pages 1 to 2. This is the omnibus order that the magistrate judge authorized. And that omnibus order in paragraph 5, Romanet 3, says—
I think, counsel, what our questions are getting at, and I can't speak for my colleagues, is we don't want to write something that goes beyond what is necessary to decide this case, if indeed we have jurisdiction under the capable of repetition yet evading review doctrine.
Yeah, so Your Honor, I think the court could decide this case in the, perhaps the narrowest way the court could decide this case would be to say, in this case, the government attained an omnibus order that specifically told the government that it was going to make the judgment that the statute assigns to the court. That's what appears on supplemental appendix 2, paragraph 5, Romanet 3. And I think that there is no way that an order which says we're making a judgment about this investigation as a whole, and now you, after the fact, the government are going to make those judgments, not the court, that can be squared with the statute. We believe the statute requires more than that. I understand that from Your Honor's questions that I may not have persuaded you, but I do think that with respect to the assignment of who has to make this judgment, the fact that the order in this case itself says that the government is going to be the one making that judgment for the course of the entire year, for the whole investigation, for any subpoena as to any account, cannot be squared with the statute. Now, Your Honor, you also asked about capable of repetition.
I know, but let me just be clear. When I ask questions, I'm not saying this is the way I think about an issue. I am trying to understand the issue and get counsel's perspective. That's all.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. And the example that I've tried to provide of why the facts and circumstances may change between different subpoenas or at different points in time is how I've tried to answer Your Honor's questions about why the even setting aside the statutory text, why it's critical that there be a subpoena-specific determination, because what was true for one subpoena as to one account is not necessarily true for a different subpoena for a different account. And what was true at time one is not necessarily true at time two. And even if the ultimate conclusion still is the same, the assessment is different. And because the statute assigns the assessment to the court, it is important that that when the facts and circumstances change, that those different facts and circumstances be able to be presented to the court so the court can still make that assessment.
Counsel, I appreciate you've already given this answer, but I just want to make sure I have it. As to what are the material circumstances that could change between time one and time two, I have things like the targets could be taken into custody, which would mean they're less able to destroy evidence, or they could find out in another way somehow about the scope of the investigation. What else was on your list?
So the evidence might be, the concerning evidence might be preserved. So there are actually a authority under the Stored Communications Act to demand preservation of certain evidence. The target of the investigation may die. I wish it weren't the case, but we have had circumstances where the government has obtained a non-disclosure order about an investigation into a deceased individual. So there are all sorts of circumstances that may change. And of course, as I explained, I think that the nature of the account may matter. If the account at issue is the target, then the considerations are going to be different than if the account is someone who's not the target. And that the ultimate conclusion may be the same, but the factual sinew that connects the request to the conclusion, I think, may differ. I've used a lot of the court. Sorry.
You'll bear with us.
Right. Well, I do.
Not
I,
in this case.
Yeah. The court, your honors have asked about the ex parte question and also about capable repetition. If I can address those questions, I also can address more about the statute if the court has other questions. Sure. I want to make sure to answer all your questions.
I appreciate that. I'm trying to have so for now, we have an as applied challenge to this particular non-disclosure order. How do we know that this one is capable of repetition as opposed to ones that have fit sort of some of the hypotheticals that we've been posing?
Well, first, because the government has told us. I mean, in the government's brief, it said, we're going to do the same thing with the same order. And so that's as good a capable of repetition, I think, as you could ask
and
for.
And I just want to make sure, and we're clear, and maybe they're the ones who better answer this, that they will have the exact type of content here and nothing more.
Well, hopefully not, because I hope the court will rule in our favor. But they have said we will pursue the same omnibus order, and so I think it's capable of repetition in that sense. I think there's other reasons for that.
Okay, go ahead with the other reasons, because what counts as omnibus order is a little confusing to me as content.
that's fair, Your Honor. This is under seal still, so I'll speak at the highest level of generality. But in the district court, the government cited to several other dockets where they said we are using omnibus orders as well. I will tell you from experience that is the practice is even more capacious, not less capacious, than we have here. Now, we asked, actually in the district court, we asked the government to give us the actual orders that they had cited in their brief. They said, these are examples of omnibus orders. And we said to the government, you're citing these examples in support of your legal argument. We'd like to see them so that we can understand and respond to them. The government refused to give them to us. I think that's emblematic of the broader ex parte problem that's presented here, but certainly there appear to be other examples by the description of the government that and our own experience that resemble this. The particular, what I've pointed the court to at pages 1 and 2 of the supplemental appendix is not something I've seen before, because we, the providers, don't usually get the authorizing order. We just get the omnibus order itself. And if the court is concerned about this, I think, truly concerned about it, I think that perhaps the solution is to order the government to give us and the court examples.
Well, the court says that order in its brief. It says this order is illustrative, referring to that the order you're talking about. So I would think that's enough to show that this dispute will repeat such that we can resolve, right?
I think that is my main submission. I also, you know, the capable repetition issue was presented in our case last term or last year around the Trump Warren case, and that's maybe illustrative here, the government in that case argued, well, we're never going to seek the former president's Twitter account again, and so it's not capable of repetition yet evading review. And this court rejected that argument and said, no, there's going to be circumstances where the government is going to seek user information and X is going to object to that, and there may be users' rights at stake, and that makes it capable of repetition yet evading review. I think that's the level of generality that makes this capable of repetition yet evading review.
I had some questions about the First Amendment, but I want to make sure my colleagues don't have questions on the other issue.
Just some questions about the ex parte issue.
Go ahead, do that.
I guess the fundamental one is one of the best cases for the government on this, at least seemingly, is this Malario case. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it resolves a First Amendment claim adversely to a plaintiff based on ex parte evidence. And it's because the evidence was protected by state secrets privilege. And so national security concerns there, grand jury concerns here. I'm just wondering how, if at all, you would have us distinguish that case.
Sure. So I think the test is the same. The test is there have to be extraordinary circumstances, and there has to be a compelling interest, and maybe most important, there have to, or for the purposes here, and maybe for distinguishing Your Honor's example, the amount withheld has to be the minimum necessary to actually serve that compelling interest. And so I think that you could, that doesn't mean that it's impossible to have a case where you could, the government could have a state secrets basis to decide the merits of a dispute on the basis of ex parte evidence. It's going to depend on the showing in the particular case and the materials that are withheld. And so to march through that analysis here, I think it sort of illustrates the problem.
I understand there's a lot of fact-specific arguments that could be made. Do you think, just in the abstract, the interest in grand jury secrecy, if we assumed this disclosure would violate the important precept of grand jury secrecy, would you argue that somehow on a lower ranking in the hierarchy than the state secret privilege, or you would have it, instead you'd be making a fact-specific argument?
So I don't think grand jury secrecy cast as grand jury secrecy is the compelling interest. I think there's a more particularized interest that underlies grand jury secrecy. Douglas Oil, I think, illustrates this. Douglas Oil, which was an interpretation of Rule 6E3 big E little I, which is actually a mechanism for obtaining disclosure of grand jury materials, talks about the particular interests that are served by grand jury secrecy. And there's three that Douglas Oil describes. One is witness intimidation. One is the risk of flight or destruction of evidence by the target. And the third is impugning the reputation of the target. And I think that the way I would think about the problem here is that I accept that the government has a compelling interest in those underlying interests that are served by grand jury secrecy. And I think then the question becomes whether the particular materials that are being withheld are actually necessary to be withheld in order to serve that interest. I actually think that's the same way that Douglas Oil, although I think there's some differences between the tests, I think that's the same way that Douglas Oil is telling courts to think about the problem of whether or not, to avoid an injustice, you should disclose grand jury materials under 6E3E little I, which is to look at the interests of the party who is losing access to the materials, and to then think about the government's particular interests in those materials, or the grand jury particular interests in those materials as set forth in Douglas Oil, and to then weigh them. Now, what I think is illustrative about the case law around 6E3E little I, maybe I screwed that up, but is that the kind of case we have here is actually the paradigmatic case for disclosure under that provision, which is where one party has the materials and the other one does not. And so that we cited two examples of this in our briefs where it actually was reversed. A criminal defendant had the materials because they'd been through the criminal process, and a civil division of the government did not. And the civil division of the government was saying, we need access to these materials. It's not fair for this case to be adjudicated where one party has access to them and the other does not. And in that circumstance, the court ordered disclosure of the materials. And so I think the kind of problem we have in this case,
which case is that?
So the In Re Grand Jury Proceedings, 76-4. That's 800 F-2nd 1293 from the Fourth Circuit is the case. And we cite another in the, I think the other we cited was in DDC 430 F-SUP 639. And so those are, I think, examples of that problem.
I appreciate, I understand that position. Want to make sure we get to Judge Millett's First Amendment questions.
Mr. Judge Rogers, has anything on the non-First Amendment issues?
No, thank you.
Okay. So just to be clear up front on one thing, characterize the speech interest as in informing the subscriber that the subpoena has been issued for them. But in fact, if you have a First Amendment interest, wouldn't be limited to that. Your company would have the ability every time one of these subpoenas comes in to broadcast on its platform to the world. Today, federal grand jury in whatever city issued subpoena for, just hypothesize, you know, a senator from the 52nd state, okay, to the senator. Next day, to the senator's spouse. And say, senator's staff members by name, the neighbors, the best buddy. Uh-oh, senator from the 53rd state got one. That's your First Amendment right.
So we're dealing here with-
You can advertise all of these to the world, not just talking. It's nice to talk about telling the subscriber. Your First Amendment right as a prior restraint would be to tell anybody, and everybody.
I do think that the non-disclosure order is a prior restraint. It's also a content-based prior restraint.
Am I wrong in saying that your First Amendment claim would be to tell the world about every single grand jury subpoena you receive? I'm not saying you would make that corporate judgment.
I do think that we would have a First Amendment right that would be intruded whenever we are, whenever a prior restraint is imposed, and then it may be that strict scrutiny could be satisfied in many of those circumstances. I think that 2705B is an attempt to, by Congress, to implement.
I don't know how strict scrutiny could be satisfied given your arguments about the lack of a real interest in keeping this confidential.
Well, I don't,
you're gonna be able to tell everybody.
I don't think, that's certainly not our position, Your Honor. The 2705B factors, I think, are demanding, but they can be satisfied. And those factors are about particular types of intrusions on the ability of the government to carry out an investigation. And our position
is
not.
Your position will be that's our free speech.
Well, free speech.
It's not often that the people who want to engage in free speech are willing to concede that strict scrutiny will prevent them from doing it.
Well, then maybe this will be the.
You will argue against in those cases. You will say we have a right to do it and the statute hasn't been met and so we get to do it.
Well, I can't prejudge.
It's a full-time job for your legal team because you're going to have to do it in every single case. Right.
Your Honor, I can't prejudge how the facts of a particular case will come out. But I do think we read 2705B and the particular statutory factors that 2705B is laying out as an attempt to actually implement the First Amendment concerns that are implicated by imposing a content-based prior restraint.
I thought you had a facial, in the district court, a facial First Amendment claim.
Well,
in the statute. Is that incorrect or correct? Maybe I misunderstood.
I don't want to dance around what is facial or what is as applied, but our challenge in this case has always been that the non-disclosure order in this case that was imposed on X both violates the statute and that it violates the First Amendment. Now, that doesn't mean that the government couldn't satisfy the First Amendment. This court held in the prior case that a particular non-disclosure order could satisfy.
What do you want us to, and you're just, in what is it that we're supposed to say violates the First Amendment? I had thought it was an attack on this statute. I could be wrong. So now you're telling me it's an attack on this particular non-disclosure order as violating the First Amendment. Is your First Amendment argument now confined? Because you did not make that argument in district court because you couldn't have. So is your argument now confined to, and you couldn't have made it in your opening brief. You didn't get the disclosure until the red brief. So is it now confined to this particular non-disclosure order violates the First Amendment?
I believe it's always been confined to this particular non-disclosure order. Are the evidence
you've
that
seen
we've
seen it before? You didn't know what it said before.
Well,
an omnibus order.
We were that's correct, Your Honor. We were able to surmise that the government had attained an order that had the features that we now learn is is the case, and we directed our argument throughout the litigation to an order where the assessment of the statutory factors was not being made by the court, and where the particular legal process had not been presented to the court, and that is the substance of our First Amendment argument. We do think that and the argument we've made to the court here is that in order, this order on pages 1 and 2 of the supplemental appendix can't satisfy the First Amendment, strict scrutiny under the First Amendment, for two reasons. One is that the causal link that strict scrutiny requires be established can't be established when the assessment is being made in the abstract of this sort. But two, and maybe even more powerfully, this is by definition not narrowly tailored, because there is by definition a more narrowly tailored order that the government could have obtained, which would be an order that is limited to one to particular subpoenas, as opposed to
across. Do you agree that if the government makes the statutorily required showing to a court, and the court finds that statutory showing has been met in an individual case, you have no First Amendment claim, no prior restraint claim?
Well, I want to be. I'm reluctant to make a commitment about a hypothetical case with respect to the company's First Amendment rights, but I think that if the court has, as a general matter, if the court has assessed particular legal process and made the judgment that 2705B requires and imposed it for a sufficiently short period of time, that we would still have a First Amendment claim, but I think strict scrutiny would ordinarily be satisfied in those circumstances.
You still have a, so sorry.
But one doesn't lose their First Amendment rights.
And this may be my misunderstanding. It seems to be a bit of a moving target here. I thought your first response to me was, oh, no, it's not a First Amendment problem if the statutory factors are met. But now you're saying, even if it's not an omnibus order, it's a single subpoena, non-disclosure order attached, the court makes, checks statutory binding boxes, 1, 2, 3, or 4 of them, imposes it for a limit of a year or 6 months. Do you still have a First Amendment prior restraint argument or not?
Well, I'm sorry if I'm being confused, Your Honor. The First Amendment doesn't go away. We still have a First Amendment right. It's still a prior restraint. Our First Amendment rights are still being intruded on, but it may well be justified under those circumstances. The First Amendment...
You're not willing to say, because I thought your first answer was that these factors were meant to address the First Amendment, but now you're saying they may not. That in every individual case where there's going to be an individual non-disclosure order, the court has to both decide. So this is now, and we're going to have, and our magistrate judges are going to be doing this 800 times a day. They're going to have to both decide that the statutory factors are met, and under your theory, your legal approach, that it satisfies strict scrutney. I just want to make sure what your position is. You'll have to issue opinions on both of those.
Your Honor, it is a prior restraint. It is a content-based.
Is the answer yes or no to my question that those findings will have to be made in each case?
The statutory factors need to be found. In the minor order of cases, the statutory factors will satisfy the First Amendment. I cannot.
I know what minor order means. Does the district court? So the district court doesn't have to do it up front. They can say this.
No, I do think the district court. Absolutely.
Why isn't the court bound? A court that's taken an oath to uphold the Constitution would seem to me, if you're saying it's a prior restraint, then they have to both apply the statute and the constitutional test every single time they get an application.
I do think that's the case, Your Honor. Okay. I do think that's okay. I think that that's the purpose of the statute, is to implement the First Amendment concern there. But I absolutely believe that before a court imposes a content-based prior restraint, that it should do so in appreciation of the serious intrusion of the First Amendment.
Application of constitutional analysis in every case. And then, so my second question then is, you have asserted, and I know we assumed this in our prior case, so it's a perfectly fine assertion on your part, strict scrutiny applies. I'm having difficulty understanding why that would be true under Reinhart. We have a case, FEC versus International Funding Institute. There's other cases where this is, the fact of the subpoena is, it's, I don't know if we can call it government speech given the nature of a grand jury, but it is not, this is not your own originated information. You essentially want to take information. It's almost like the discovery cases, right? You want to take, like in Reinhart, you want to take information that you have learned from the government and broadcast it out and as a commercial business. why, what is your best case that strict scrutiny applies in that context?
Well, this court certainly assumed that strict scrutiny applied. I think Reed, I mean, the Reed case from the Supreme Court sets forth the test for content-based restrictions and asks, is the restriction turn on the content of the speech? This statute certainly.
You're a regulated industry, and party regulations is participation in the statutory schemes, regulatory schemes like this, and the information, you have to be the conduit for the government. And all they've said is, when you would not know this information otherwise. And what the government has said, well, when we necessarily have to share this information with you, it has to be done under confidentiality rules. And we argue about the statute and the confidentiality rules, but if we assume they're met,
Your Honor, we're a convenient, the government.
That is merits strict scrutiny.
Your Honor, we are not a regulated institution in any way that term has ever been used. We are a convenient source of information for the government. But when we talk about regulated institutions, we're talking about banks that are subject to an entire regulatory regime. We're not talking about an entity that happens to have a large amount of information the government is interested in, and that because the government is interested in that information, that alone, because that's the Stored Communications Act is, you know, this provision of it is setting up a regime to gain information from the company. Now, Your Honor mentioned the Reinhart case, and I do think there's a very significant difference in that case. In the Reinhart case, the newspaper in that case had used the compulsive force of civil discovery to obtain information. And then having actually used the coercive powers of the court to get information, it then wanted to talk about that information. And that makes no sense, because there's a quid pro quo that if you're going to get the benefit of having used the coercive powers of the court to gain information, if the court then says if you're going to get that information, it now has to be subject to restrictions. That's very different when, in this circumstance, X has not gained anything from the government. It has simply received.
The very piece of information you want to broadcast to the world is something that comes from, and I'm characterizing a grand jury subpoena as coming from the government. It's not something you've originated or created or your business has generated.
There's much information that people learn from the government. That's the very entire point of the First Amendment, is that when parties learn what the government is up to, they have the choice about whether to speak about that. And that is because investigations may be of all stripes and shapes, and there may be serious malfeasance that's reflected in that investigation. Now, X is a steward of its users' information. That is the commitment it makes in its terms of service, but it's also the purpose of the Stored Communications Act. The purpose of the Stored Communications Act was to assign to X and other providers to be reliable stewards of their users' information.
To also make it possible, it's not just one way. It's a balanced statute, and it very much wants to make it possible for very important governmental interests of law and order to be able to get this information. And it's sort of a deal, all right? We've discussed here what showings have to be made, but Congress's assumption is that when the appropriate statutory showing is made, so I assume that for these questions, and this information comes into you, that you will treat it with confidentiality.
If that's
the balance, then I don't know how that's a full-throated First Amendment strict scrutiny argument.
Well, Your Honor, it is the deal. It is a balance. In the balance that the statute is trying to strike is between not just the providers, but the users having the ability to protect their rights, and at the same time, the government being able to obtain non-disclosure when it's truly necessary. And the way that the statute strikes that balance is that there be judicial assessment of the statutory factors on a subpoena by subpoena basis. And I wholly accept that in the mine run of cases, that framework will satisfy the First Amendment. I don't think that that means that the provider's First Amendment rights disappear. It simply means that under those circumstances, the compelling interests and the narrow tailoring that the First Amendment demands and that the statute demands have been satisfied. And I think that I can't sign away the idea that there will not be particular cases where the First Amendment balance will strike, will come out differently.
Is maintaining grand jury secrecy a compelling interest for strict scrutiny purposes?
By itself, no, Your Honor. And this, in fact, not even what this court said in its decision in our case from the prior term. What the court said is that grand jury secrecy serves compelling interests, not that itself is a compelling interest. And the interests that it serves have to do with concern about witness intimidation or witnesses' willingness to speak candidly.
Substantial interference with a law enforcement investigation, or with an investigation.
Yeah, I think that is serious, destroying evidence, intimidating witnesses.
There's a fourth category. Is that fourth category, the fourth statutory category?
Yes, and it needs to be read in light of the four that come.
Interest?
As long as it's read in light of the compelling, the four that come before it, and that it is truly a serious jeopardizing of the investigation, yes. If that's not, I mean, you know, this is, we're, providers are not alone in raising these concerns. Congress very recently issued a report saying that the non-disclosure orders had become, quote, a box-checking exercise. I do not think that a box-checking exercise is consistent with the statute or the First Amendment.
Congress is concerned they can amend the statute, but that's, I'm not sure what we're supposed to do with that.
Well, I think we have to, Your Honor, from the beginning, the Congress enacted a statute that has demanding requirements. It said in its legislative history that it was supposed to apply in a, quote, narrow set of circumstances, and that one of its purposes was to give users confidence that they would have the opportunity to protect their rights. Your Honor, of course, we cannot amend the statute. We're asking the court simply to enforce the statute as it's written, and the non-disclosure order in this case did not do that because, among other things, this is a statute that assigns the responsibility for assessing the statutory factors to the court, and the order that was obtained in this case instead delegated those responsibilities to the government. So yes, X is very concerned about abuse of the non-disclosure process and asks only that the court enforce the statute as it is written, which was not the case here. And that is the concern that we've raised.
Just one more question. You had, as you began early in your argument, listing a number of other statutes that impose non-disclosure orders. So your position that every one of those statutes also requires, before its issuance, not just statutory compliance, but a strict scrutiny analysis, case-by-case basis?
I do think that whenever the government imposes a content-based prior restraint on speech, that it has to satisfy strict scrutiny. So I think, as I described with the Wiretap Act, I think that the rationale that undergirds non-disclosure in the Wiretap Act is always...
Any case applied strict scrutiny under these other statutes? Say the Wiretap Act.
Well, the Mukasey case from the Second Circuit, I don't think we've cited in this case, but we've cited in prior cases, like this court's decision in the practice, assumed that strict scrutiny applies in this context. The government has not argued that strict scrutiny does not apply. I'm not familiar with a court not applying strict scrutiny in this case.
I'm really just asking the question.
No, I don't.
Statutes here that are similar to this and have been in operation for a very long time. And
so,
would we be the first court to hold that strict scrutiny applies?
No, so I think the Butterworth decision of the Supreme Court is perhaps close here, Your Honor. In the Butterworth decision, the court struck down a Florida statute, which in the context of a Florida grand jury, not a federal grand jury, prohibited witnesses from being able to speak about information that was on their own knowledge simply because they've been called to testify before the grand jury. And so that's a context where, because of the party's engagement or interaction with in that case, Florida grand jury, they were prohibited from speaking about information they already knew, and as a result,
before the grand jury, it was a permanent ban. Justice Scalia wrote, quite a different question is presented by witness disclosure of grand jury proceedings, which is knowledge he acquires not on his own, but only by virtue of being made a witness. It discloses those proceedings, right? Not what he knew, right? Justice Scalia.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Voice the very, very distinction that we've been talking about here.
He did for himself, but not for the court.
That case was dealing with the witness's own information it had wholly separate and apart from the grand jury permanent ban.
I acknowledge, Your Honor, that's a different, that was presenting a different question, but I think what that case illustrates is the fact that one has engaged with law enforcement in the grand jury investigation and law enforcement has decided that being able to speak about the topic at hand, that is going to trigger strict scrutiny and will raise the same First Amendment concerns that we've raised here. Now, Your Honor, I cannot point, Your Honor, to a particular example exactly on point with this case, nor can the government.
That's a fair. I'm really just asking because there's other statutes here which haven't been briefed to us for obvious reasons. It would be a first for us to hold the strict scrutiny applies to statutory non-disclosure orders in criminal investigatory contexts.
Well, what this court did previously and what the Mukasey court did was to assume.
I'm fully aware of what we've done previously. I'm just trying to ask a simple fact.
I'm not aware.
You don't know, and I'm
assuming. I'm not aware. I don't have to cite for the government, for the court, I'm sorry, an example of a court affirmatively holding that strict scrutiny applies in this context. I believe it does for all the reasons we've said, which is that it's a prior restraint, it is content-based under all relevant tests. And I think the cases that that have been referred to, like the Reinhardt case, is wholly distinguishable.
All right. Do my colleagues have any other questions? Judge Rogers, any more questions?
Oh, thank you.
Sorry, we kept you up for a little bit longer.
I'm happy to answer the court's questions, and obviously if the court has others, I'd be happy to answer them as well. I'm
very grateful for your time, and we'll give you some rebuttal time as well if you want to talk more.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Government? Okay. Sorry. Excuse me, counsel. I think we're just going to take a quick 5-minute break. Is that okay? Everybody? Quick 5-minute recess. Thank you.
This honorable court is again in session. Be seated, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, and may it please the court, Dan Lenners for the United States. If I might briefly touch upon mootness, we did not argue that the arguments raised by X Corp were moot because of the high level of generality at which they raised them initially, that no multi-subpoena, multi-provider non-disclosure order can possibly comply with 2705B, and that they are absolutely entitled under due process to access to the ex parte evidence the government provided as part of its application. As this litigation has progressed, those arguments appear to have become more fact-specific. For example, the ex parte argument, at least as I read the reply brief, turned in large part on things that had been made public about the targets of this investigation. That more fact-specific application, in my view, appears to be moot under this court's precedent in PETA that we cited in our brief. The more that the outcome of the case turns on the particular facts, the more likely it is to be moot. And so we don't think that the high-level challenges are moot. They are capable of repetition yet evading review, but the more fact-specific applications may well be. In terms of the...
Which category does your omnibus order in this case fall into, given, as Judge Garcia pointed out earlier, you said it's illustrative. So does that fall into high level?
So certainly the question whether the statute categorically prohibits any potential multi-provider, multi-subpoena.
No. Try again. Whether it prohibits this illustrative omnibus order.
So my understanding is that this order has a lot in common with these orders, but is not identical to all of them. One typical difference is that orders are often limited to non-disclosure of subpoenas that seek information for the particular target's accounts, whereas this order, as the court noted, is more broad insofar as it restricts disclosure for any accounts, not just target's accounts. But the other aspects of this order, my understanding, are largely common, mostly in common with the kinds of orders, at least issued in this jurisdiction, or sought by the government in this jurisdiction.
Different in different jurisdictions?
I can't speak to that. I just don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
You're saying the typical order that's this kind of ex-ante omnibus order would be limited to accounts the government believes are associated with identified individuals, but this one is not, and that's the respect in which...
That's my understanding, Your Honor. I can't say that every other order is limited to the targets of the investigation, but I think it's more common that they are, and this order doesn't contain that limitation. But the other limitations in the order, meaning that they have to be part of this investigation, limited to certain kinds of providers, have to be for grand jury subpoenas, for subscriber information, and that the underlying facts are the same, I think are common across the orders sought by the government. And it's...
When you say most common, is this a one-off Or is this 20% and 80% or the other way?
I don't know, Your Honor. I haven't seen enough of
it. Common then.
I think I could ask my colleague, but I personally don't know the answer to that.
Well, we kind of need to know that to know if there's a real mootness thing here.
Well, one of the concerns I had is the fact that in this case, the government request was granted by the magistrate judge on the same day as the request was submitted. And certainly we have had instances of expedited appeals. And I just thought maybe that's the better way to do this in terms of, just as you say, the reply brief said a lot of things because information became available to it. Now, at oral argument, you're providing the court with additional information as to why what's in the supplemental appendix is, may not be illustrative. And to the extent that what the government's interest here is seeking a broader guidance, I'm just wondering, what kind of guidance can you get from us other than an advisory opinion where the arguments are going to change, things are going to happen? I'm just very troubled by this. I'm not sure what we are going to say other than that there's some interesting arguments about how this statute should be interpreted.
I certainly think the court could say the statute
it
does not
say. I understand that. And it could say, as I understood the argument, that unlike where X started, the statute didn't bar anything other than a very particularized order. And I thought that's what your brief was focusing on.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the court could resolve this dispute, which is not moot, which is the question whether 2705B categorically prohibits any multi-provider, multi-subpoena non-disclosure order. The more fact-specific question as to whether this particular order is lawful, I think the answer that my colleague gave is even he doesn't know how often the orders contain the additional limitation that they are limited to accounts held by the targets of the investigation.
Well, let me ask it this way. Are you able to commit that the government will not again seek a omnibus NDO order that is not limited to identified targets of an investigation?
I am not able to make that commitment, Your Honor.
Okay. So I think that's the case we have, and at least it seems to me that it's sufficiently likely to repeat, and it should include that feature of the case.
I have no basis to push against that, Your Honor. I think, for example, on the ex parte nature arguments, to the degree they deal with public information or information about the investigation having become public, those likely are moot, that more specific argument rather than the more general due process right to any ex parte evidence. In terms of compliance with the statute, the district court correctly found that nothing.
But counsel, could I just, so I'm clear on your position, I understand your answer to Judge Garcia. I thought part of the capable of repetition yet evading review doctrine was a timeliness concern, that you couldn't get a decision if there were to be an appeal, and of course, it's a petition for cert, et cetera. So that I appreciated that, but I wondered sort of what use this is going to be to you.
Well, so my understanding of the timeliness question, as this court set forth in sealed case, is right, that you have to have review before these orders expire. And by their own terms, they typically expire no later than a year. And in that case, it was 180 days. And because, and this court has said that anything that would become moot in less than 2 years is capable, satisfies the evading review aspect of capable of repetition yet evading review. And it, so because these orders are typically per DOJ guidance sought for no longer than a year and oftentimes shorter, we think this is capable of repetition yet evading review. And I'm sorry, the government's not here asking the court to review this and bless this. X brought a challenge. We think it's the order was correctly issued under the statute and that under this court's guidance from sealed case, it's not moot. So we think the court should rule in the government's favor because we think the district court correctly found that nothing in the statute.
Well, I understood it. Yeah, okay. All right. I won't take up any more time.
Get us started on the statutory authority question.
Yeah.
Can I just direct you to at least one of the things that seems odd here is that on Supplemental Appendix 2, it's the provision that your opposing counsel highlighted. It requires the government to check whether disclosure of the existence of the subpoena would result in one of the listed harms. And if your position is the court made that determination for all potential hypothetical future subpoenas, I think the question is, why is that there?
I'm not sure why it's there. I think the important language from that provision is the first sentence, which is that the facts proffered in the government's application for this omnibus order must apply to each and every subpoena to which the order is attached. And so our view is that the court found—
And who checks that the facts in the application apply to each and every subpoena to which the order is attached? It's not the court.
Correct. It's the government. But that's not a legal determination. It's a factual determination. So the court has found that facts A, B, and C are true today. And most often, one of those facts is going to be that the target is unaware of the government's investigation. And the court says, if those facts remain true, the government may attach the nondisclosure order to subpoenas meeting these criteria. And so the court has made the determination that under facts A, B, and C, which continue to exist, as the government evaluates them,
that seems to be the whole nub of the case, right? The judge does not know and cannot determine that those facts will continue to exist. That's why the last provision is here. I, the magistrate judge, have no idea whether whenever you decide to pursue a subpoena, the target will know about the investigation. So you, government, check. And I guess the concern is that seems directly contrary to the statute, because it's the government making that determination, not the court.
So I think it's a different determination. The court has to find that under the world of facts, that there is a reason to believe that notification of the existence of the subpoena will result in a statutory harm. So the court is the one who says, yes, if facts A, B, and C are true, the statutory harm will result. The government isn't making the determination that a statutory harm will result. That's for the court. It's simply making the determination that the world of facts described in its application that were true at the time the court entered its order remain true. And again, typically one of those facts is that the target is unaware of the investigation. And so the government's not making a legal conclusion that the target's unawareness will lead to a statutory harm. The court has made that determination. The government's just looking out at what it knows about the real world and the facts that exist in the real world.
So when the statute, I guess the difficulty I have with that is that when the statute says the court has to find reason to believe, for example, destruction of evidence will result, that's a legal question, sure. That's a factual question. The court checks whether the facts are true. And as you're laying it out, this order delegates, outsources to the executive branch the power to decide if the facts remain true. And the facts, again, the facts are that the facts remain true is an essential part of the determination the statute requires, isn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The court doesn't evaluate whether the facts are true. The government proffers facts. There's no independent investigation as to whether this remains true. The government proffers that these things are true, and that based on that, the court concludes that applying that factual world, that a statutory harm is likely to, or will result from notification. And so the government's not making a legal conclusion about whether these facts add up to the requisite harm. They're simply evaluating whether these facts remain true. And I don't think that replaces the role of the judge as set forth by the statute.
So I appreciate that argument. The other aspect of it that opposing counsel emphasized, as I already noted, is the breadth. And so the idea that This is just limited to anything the government later deems relevant to the investigation, which I think you've acknowledged could mean different people in different circumstances. And that would seem to be an even more sort of hypothetical determination. The magistrate judge doesn't know who the future targets could be. And so it can't tell whether disclosure to those people would jeopardize the investigation, can it?
So, I think that would be, that is a limitation that could be put in to these orders to say the targets at this time are person A and B, and only subpoena seeking their accounts meet the statutory criteria. That the court may find that that's necessary for a future looking order to
see. Do you have an argument that it's not necessary since this order doesn't have it?
I think it's the same concern that regardless of who is notified of the existence of the subpoena, a court could find that that will lead to a statutory harm. So they don't have to evaluate whose account is being subpoenaed, because if that person is notified, then the targets could find out and it could lead to the requisite
statutory harm. So I don't want to be argumentative about it, but it is right. The court could find, right? But the whole problem with there not being a limit to the targets is that it could just be a subpoena to someone who the government believes has information. They have no idea. They have no connection to the two targets. There's no basis to believe they. If I get, a subpoena, I have no idea it's about an inquiry into these two people, and then I'm going to tell them. And this order, by hypothesis at least, the magistrate judge has somehow determined that anyone in my situation or any of the other situations would somehow have a risk of either deleting their own evidence or notifying the targets of the investigation. And it just seems like we're in a, I actually don't think the magistrate judge would have any belief that they were making that determination in this case.
Well certainly,
because you can't.
Certainly if, certainly in that situation, if X Corp, for example, is not limited by a non-disclosure order, they aren't just limited to notifying the recipients of the subpoena, but as Judge Millett put out, they could just publish it on their website. We received these subpoenas for these people. And so a court could make the requisite finding that a savvy target who's aware of that happening, would be tipped off and destroy evidence. Again, if the court's going to rule that these are consistent with 2705B, so long as they are limited to the targets of the investigation, that I don't think would be require a significant change from what I understand to be the government's most common practice in this jurisdiction. And I think most often these orders are issued when there are in fact sort of large groups of targets who are creating many accounts, and thus the efficiencies in and the time consumed in going back to the court every time you find a new account are sufficient that the government wants an order that allows it to issue the same non-disclosure order to once a new account is discovered.
Can you just help us understand what kind of burden that actually is? As Judge Rogers noted, I mean, this order was entered the same day that it was requested. How much, and I think X concedes you could do it in batches, can come forward with the 30 subpoenas you've decided to issue every 2 weeks and get your NDO. You just can't do it 2 weeks in advance. What's the...
My understanding is that there are cases in which it's a significant burden, where you're talking about, say, hypothetically, a group of 15 hackers who are setting up, dozens or hundreds of accounts, and that the government is sort of trying to move rapidly in identifying these accounts and who they belong to. And that's all they're doing here. All they're doing is getting subscriber information. And so the speed at which the government's discovering new accounts and the number of accounts would require quite an administrative burden both on the government and the court for the government to go back and reapply for a non-disclosure order every time it finds a new account.
Why is that? You still have to do the subpoena. You have to get a subpoena in each and every one of those cases. And presumably that's going to make some showing to the grand jury and or a judge if you want it enforced. And so you're already having to make the subpoena showing. And then, you know, this is a computer age, right? Most of this non-disclosure order is not going to change, but you will have the obligation to sort of update, you know, who and why you're going after this so that it's merits the exception of non-disclosure, right? Non-disclosure is the exception under the statute.
Non-disclosure is the exception under the statute, Your Honor, but I don't want to minimize the burden. A grand jury subpoena, issuing a grand jury subpoena, mailing it off, or uploading it to X's website, however it's done these days, is very different than resubmitting a court order, changing the non-disclosure order to account for the specific subpoena, uploading those things to PACER, burdening the magistrate judge, whoever it is, on, you know, potentially a daily basis or a weekly basis with reviewing these materials.
Is it not possible to group them, as Judge Garcia was suggesting?
It's certainly possible to group them, and I think that's...
There's nothing would stop you from having here are 1,000 accounts that have been identified as potentially related to X, sorry, I shouldn't use X here, but Y person's conduct, and that person is unaware of the investigation and nothing else. You just have to, is still unaware of the investigation to our knowledge. That's all you have to add.
It's certainly true that the government could group them. And I think X's concession that that would be permissible in its reply brief is not entirely consistent with its argument at the outset that the statutory
its argument has evolved, but that's because the government sort of, you know, threw a whole new information into the case at the appellee stage of this case. So, you know, it's fair for them to clarify and evolve their position, but the question we are now dealing with, I still am having a little trouble understanding the computer era, why the government can't group these together, because presumably it's not doing one, you know, if it just discovers something new every hour, it could just, here's today, here's what we've got today, let's send it in. It's on the case to make sure we have that staffed.
I want to be clear, the government can group them. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is a possibility. We don't think the statute requires it. We don't think any of the
things. It is feasible.
It is feasible, and it adds as my understanding is, as an appellate attorney who doesn't file these things, a non-negligible administrative burden on both the government and the courts to get a multi-subpoena, multi-provider non-disclosure order that applies to a discrete set of facts and a discrete set of subpoenas.
So the most you're saying is it's a non-negligible burden?
That's the most I can say, yes, Your Honor. But again, we don't think that burden, whether these comply with the statute turns on the nature of the burden. It's certainly, whether it's permissible under the statute, you know, doing this for the courts, you know, to help the court with its administrative tasks and to avoid burden by the government is why the government started using
that. That may be all fine and well, but if the statutory determination, which is to be made by the court, that harm will occur, is not being made.
And
this is not being made in this order. This order says the government must decide that the harm will happen.
That's
factual. I mean, the sentence legal is just listing the statutory types of harm that can be there. That's all that this order does. And then says the government must decide that harm will occur as to this subpoena. And the statute says the court will decide that question. So I think it's not just efficiencies. There is a material, this is just what Judge Garcia was raising with you. There's a material change in how the process is working under the statute. If the magistrate judge had found up front that this will apply, my findings of harm will apply to subpoenas issued by this grand jury under X, Y, and Z circumstances, that would be a different case. We don't have a will finding by the magistrate judge.
So I disagree that this order doesn't comply with the Act for the reasons I stated to Judge Garcia. The magistrate found that facts A, B, and C were true, and that based on those facts, it had a reason to believe that notification will result in a statutory harm. And
Where did it say it had a reason to believe that statutory harm will occur for every ensuing subpoena for the next year?
That's the required statutory finding.
What language you're finding that in?
It's a Rule 27-5B says the court.
I'm sorry, where are you finding it in this order? I apologize, in this order.
Oh, well, the court may only issue this order. And it says in the second sentence, having carefully considered the application, the court finds reasonable.
Which paragraph are you in?
I'm sorry, the first paragraph, mm-hmm. Second sentence. Having carefully considered the application, the court finds reasonable grounds to believe that disclosure of such subpoenas will result in flight, destruction, or tampering with evidence, intimidation of witnesses, and serious jeopardy.
That's talking about in that time, or is it talking about in the, it's just there's a confusion between that will and then the government must in paragraph five. What are we supposed to do about that?
So the application set forth the world of facts that are ex parte that the government proffered to establish that there is a reason to believe that disclosure of this category of subpoenas will result in a statutorily enumerated harm. My understanding of paragraph five is that requires that those facts remain true at any time the government uses this non-disclosure order.
So the government has to determine that. So the magistrate judge, she was not predetermining that that would be true in every situation.
Correct. So for
example,
correct. So as the best example,
that's a shift from the statute, which requires the court to find that it will happen for each subpoena.
So I think the court has already
textually hear about the difference, the gap between the two.
And I don't see the gap. The court has found that facts A, B, and C are true. And based on those facts, a statutorily enumerated harm will result. And if facts A, B, and C are true on December 20th, the government and they remain true on December 21st, I don't see any reason why the statute would require the government to go back for a new application or on January 1st.
That November 18th of the next year, they're still true?
Particularly, yes. If those facts, for example, as the Justice Manual points out, the most typical fact for this kind of subpoena is that the target is unaware of the existence of the government's investigation. And the court could certainly find that if once this target finds out, whenever that is, that target is likely to destroy evidence or intimidate witnesses. And so if that fact remains true, then that the target doesn't know, then a statutory harm is likely to result by the target being informed by an electronic communication service provider.
But if the government...
You would agree that if the person finds out, in the ordinary case, the person learns about the investigation before the subpoena is issued, and at the time the subpoena issues, there is no reason to believe that disclosure of the subpoena would lead to these listed harms. I think that's the concession.
I think that's often, but not always true. Certainly a person can understand that they're under investigation for A, B, and C and think the government doesn't know about their secret email account under an alias that they're using to intimidate witnesses. And so that would be a fact-specific determination. But it's certainly a fact that if it changes, and the government still thinks that disclosure would result in a harm, it would have to go back to the magistrate judge. If that fact, for example, is set forth in the application, that's a factual change. And the government may still think that the legal test is met, but it would have to, under this order, go back to the magistrate to get a new non-disclosure order.
Why would it? Because the magistrate judge allows the government to decide that there's still a risk, a statutory risk of harm.
That is part of the order, but I think the important part of the order is the first sentence of paragraph five, which is that the facts proffered apply to each and every subpoena. So that's not that the legal conclusion applies. It is that the facts as set forth in the government's application remain true today. I'm happy to talk about the government's use of ex parte materials or the First Amendment. Judge Millett, to answer a question you have from my opposing counsel, the Third Circuit in In Re Subpoena in 2020 did apply strict scrutiny to non-disclosure orders issued under 2705B.
Did it hold that that's what the law requires, or it just assumed?
It held that, Your Honor. The government argued that a lesser form of scrutiny applied, and the court rejected that argument. Oh, and then just another, I guess, hanging fruit. Your Honor asked about whether 2705B only applies to grand jury subpoenas. The answer to that is no. 2705A talks about delayed notification and speaks in terms of a governmental entity and it where an administrative subpoena authorized by a federal or state statute is obtained. And then B says when it is a governmental entity acting when it is not required to notify the subscriber or customer under section 2703B1 or to the extent that it may delay such notice pursuant to subsection A. So I think taken together, it makes clear that the government may seek a non-disclosure order under 2705B when, for example, it issues an administrative subpoena under it, that for which it would have be able to delay notification under 2705A.
So these apply to civil as well as criminal subpoenas? I'm not sure what you mean by administrative here.
I don't know the answer to that. I just looking at the statute, it speaks of a governmental entity and an administrative subpoena. I suspect that means civil subpoenas, but I don't know enough about how that I don't practice with the statute. So I don't know the answer to that.
Just one question on the First Amendment. I think X on the narrow tailoring argument essentially says can't be narrowly tailored because there's a less restrictive alternative. You could wait till you have the specific subpoena and the actual current facts and have that adjudicated. And that's just a less of a ex ante restriction on speech than the case by case approach. And I'm not, what is your response to that in terms of the First Amendment?
So I think I have two responses. The first is that as this court made clear in sealed case last year, First Amendment requires narrow tailoring, not perfect tailoring. And the second is that regardless of any of that, the subpoena that's ultimately, the non-disclosure order that's ultimately issued to each provider restricts the same narrow slice of speech, which is the ability to inform the subscriber or anyone else about the existence of the subpoena, which is information they only learned as a result of being a grand jury witness. They are limited in time duration and X remains free to speak about anything else, X or any other provider. And so the reasons that this court found last year that narrow tailoring satisfies a single non-disclosure order.
The omnibus order has no effect until it's attached.
Until it's attached, and the effect on speech is, yes, and the effect on speech for any given provider is exactly the same.
Are these subpoenas just issued directly by the grand jury, or did they go through a court?
I believe the subpoenas themselves are issued directly by the grand jury, Your Honor.
And their standard is what per subpoena?
I don't know if there's any legal standard applicable to a grand jury subpoena, but I don't know the answer to that question.
So then it's hard. I mean, it's hard to know in advance and what on earth the grand jury is going to be. I mean, it's a pretty low standard, as I recall. So, you know, the sweep of things that a grand jury could issue a subpoena for, it's very hard to anticipate 6 months or a year in advance. And if you don't have a sense of the sweep, how can you have a sense that these harms will continue to occur?
Well, I don't know
how far reaching these subpoenas are going to be.
So I disagree that you don't have a sense of the sweep. The order under which the government attaches the non-delegation order requires it to be part of this specific investigation to a provider as defined by statute, only seek subscriber information. So that in and of itself is a significant narrowing of the sweep of any grand jury subpoena issued within a year, and then the underlying facts have to be the same. And so as the district court found and the government argued below, the only difference between these subpoenas is the specific account to which it applies, Gmail account X versus Gmail account Y, or Twitter account X versus Twitter account Y. Otherwise, they are identical.
The relevant facts about risk, I think, are what the concern is here.
I understand that. And we think the order appropriately accounts for that by requiring the underlying facts remain true at the time the government uses the non-delegation order.
Judge Rogers, do you have more questions? Any questions?
I guess not. Okay.
Thank you very much, Counsel.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Holzblatt, we'll give you 3 minutes. Turn it into an hour again.
I will only go as long as the court wants me to. Just a couple small points, Your Honor. The first is that I want to address the language of the delegation order that we've been discussing. As Judge Garcia, as you mentioned, I honestly don't know how the magistrate could possibly have made the determination that my friend highlighted in the second sentence on page one, because this was not limited only to targets. It wasn't, you know, the opposing counsel said, this is just all that's changed the account identifier. Well, that's a big deal if we're talking about the target versus someone who's not the target. And it's just inconceivable to me how you could make the kind of judgment that the statute requires with respect to the wide swath of subpoenas that are covered by this, let alone the time frame that's covered. The second is on the first sentence in paragraph five on page two.
I'm not clear on that argument. Just help me here. I mean, the government could have submitted volumes to the magistrate judge describing things.
I'm obviously at a massive disadvantage, which is our other argument, because I don't know what was in the application.
But you act as though you said, I just need to be clear. I mean, a lot of things we don't know, but there's nothing that says that the government is limited to 4 pages of description. That's all I'm getting at.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I guess my point is that as the breadth of the order expands,
right,
the permutations that would be necessary to make any kind of reliable judgment expand massively. And I think that if you're saying, here's my Gmail account and my X account, then you're talking about accounts that I own both of them, and all we're talking about is a different provider. And if it's the same day, then you can imagine that the factual judgment on the exact same day with respect to the exact same account owner, and it just happens to be two different platforms, that's a judgment that is coherent to me. If we're now talking about potentially a large number of individuals, some of whom are targets, some of whom are not targets, we're talking about lots of different platforms, and we're talking about an entire year where the subpoena might be served, the permutations of change rapidly increase. And I think that's the judgment that I just think is not the kind of judgment the statute demands could be made with respect to that volume of permutations.
And I guess what I'm pressing you on is sort of there was a 20th century view of law enforcement, and now it's changed in the 21st century because the world has changed, and prosecuting has necessarily changed in response to the challenges faced by the computerized world.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And Congress struck a particular balance when it enacted the statute that was designed to protect the rights of the providers and the users while also enabling the government to carry out, to obtain non-disclosure when it was necessary.
But I thought the balance was, yes, but it's having the court make this decision. And sometimes that decision will favor your client, and sometimes it may not.
The key is the court.
In other words, it doesn't require an outcome where your client agrees that my rights were properly balanced. That's all I'm getting.
I 100% agree, Your Honor. The court needs to make that judgment. That's the problem in this case, is that the way this order was set up, the court wasn't doing that. And but I, you're, one of the big things that has changed since the 1980s when the statute was enacted is that maybe there are a larger volume of accounts. I heard my friend to say there was a non-negligible burden, which actually doesn't, I mean, frankly, doesn't sound like a huge amount of burden. And I do want to point one thing out, which I actually view that as a feature, not a bug, of the statute. That there is a need to balance very important interests here, the interests of the users and the provider on the one hand, and the government on the other, and the friction, the little bit of friction that having to come back to the court, you can do it in batches, actually make sure that the balance has been properly struck. I've used the court's time, so there were a couple other points, but really it's the court's time. So if the court has other questions, I want to make sure to answer them.
Any more questions, Judge Rogers?
No, thank you.
I'll give you a minute to wrap up. Just maybe you can squeeze many other points in if you wish to, because we've dominated your time.
thank you, Your Honor. I the only last point I want to make is on with respect to paragraph 5 on page 2. You know, I don't know what the facts were proffered in the government's application. My friend said typically. She don't know if that's even true here, because he used the word typically. But there's very few facts that are listed in this paragraph. If there were facts that were important, I would have expected to see them here, and I don't. And the most important thing that's listed here is the statutory factors that need to be satisfied. The last thing I want to say, and I'll close here, Your Honor, is that X takes its users' privacy and its users' rights incredibly seriously. There was some hypothetical mention about posting everything online and blaring it to all the world. We know that's not true. It wasn't true in this particular case. What X, in the vast majority of circumstances, merely wants to do is inform its users privately that their interests might be implicated, so that those users can decide for themselves what to do about it. And that's all we seek to do here, to be a reliable steward of our users' information. If the court has no further questions, I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you very much. Thanks to counsel on both sides for your argument. The case is submitted.